From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Denise. Education meets prison, Pope.
Education meets prison. That's not even a thing.
No, I know. I couldn't think of it.
I thought you were going to say Denise never been in jail, Pope.
But I don't know that.
I know, but I can tell you that is true.
Anyway, we're talking about prison and education today. So
we are, and Dan, I have a little quiz for you. Little. See if
joy.
I can stump
joy.
Dan Schwartz, okay? All right. First one is rather
Six.
Broad.
No.
No. Wait till I ask the question. This okay. is not Jeopardy. How many people are in U.S. prisons and jails total?
Total.
Total.
So I know there's been a huge increase because of, like, I think it's the change in laws rather than an increase in crime. 2 million.
Oh, you are good. It's 2.2 million.
Wow.
Dan Schwartz.
You know how many teachers there are?
In jail?
No.
Total?
Yeah,
total.
In the US.
How many?
2 million.
Wow. That's an interesting fact right there. Okay. What percent of those 2.2 million in prisons and jails in the United States are people of color?
Oh, I'm sure it's disproportionate. Can I choose one type of color, like African Americans?
I don't have it broken down.
Okay. I'm going to go 70%.
Okay, it's 60.
60%.
But yes, you're right. It's disproportional, right?
Yeah.
It's disproportional. Okay, now we're going to go to public school enrollment. What percentage of public school enrollment? I got to say this better. What percentage of all kids enrolled in public schools are black?
30%.
16%.
Oh, God.
Yeah, which
I'm
is
terrible.
Low. No. You were doing good until, but that's okay.
I should know this.
Okay, but now I think you're gonna get better on this one.
It must be where I taught, where I got that.
So now what
disproportion?
Okay, well, what percent of all students who have been suspended multiple times are black?
60%.
42. But so these are high.
They're horrible statistics.
Right? Black students represent 31% of all school-related arrests, and they are suspended and expelled three times more than white students. For similar offenses.
Yeah, these are just horrible.
It's horrible.
This is horrible. Here's one for you.
Yeah.
Which nation incarcerates the largest percentage of its population?
We do.
Yeah, the U.S.
I mean, by far.
Yeah.
By far. It's very, very frustrating.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
So given that, I sort of wonder what Americans think jail and prison are like. You know, like they've seen Rocky movies.
Yeah.
You know, or they've seen Sylvester Stallone movies. And that's their image of what prison's like or something.
Yeah.
So one time my son was a very good basketball player in the high school team, and they arranged to have the high school basketball team play the prison team. This
Whoa.
Wasn't jail. This was prison. So these are people who are there for a long time. And, you know, the imagination of what he was walking into, you know, that there be these big guys, prison strong, knocking them down. And it turned out they were just like so happy to have him come, and everybody was cheering for him when they made good shots, you know.
Yeah, no, of course. And I have friends who teach in at San Quentin. And again, by the time you get to be with certain teachers, maybe you're on good behavior or whatnot. But they say they're really wonderful, good
Yeah.
students who want to learn, and it's very rewarding for my friends who teach them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Very much so.
Do they ever see what happens to them when they leave prison? Do they get to follow up? Or?
I don't know if they follow up.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah. It's the handoff between institutions. That's where the vulnerable always fall.
That's where you fall through the cracks
yeah,
sometimes.
It's, yeah. You know, from medicine to education, education of the workforce. If you're vulnerable, that's sort of where it all falls apart.
Well, and this is why this show is on the school to prison pipeline.
That is correct. And we're going to find out what that means, because we had a debate over what that means. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Peter Williamson. He is the director of our secondary teacher education program. He also has a forthcoming book called Deconstructing the School to Prison Pipeline. So welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Dan.
What is it? What is the school to prison pipeline?
School to prison pipeline is a metaphor that is being used to describe the way that kids are funneled from schools out onto the streets, often by getting suspended or other sort of disciplinary strategies, and end up getting caught up in the juvenile justice system, where we know that there's a real cycle that starts there. Once you've been caught by that system, you often return to it.
So before we go to the second point, which is about the cycle and maybe prison education can stop that. So is the mechanism that I get suspended from school, I'm not in school, so now I start hanging out with bad actors, and that gets me going the wrong direction? Is that?
I think that's one way to look at it. I think another way to look at it is that in school, you're supervised and surrounded by people who are doing things that are similar to what you're being asked to do. And when you're pushed out of school, you're not being supervised and you're left to your own devices in a variety of ways. Who knows if parents are at home, they're working. Who knows what your friends have been doing, they might be suspended too. And so you've set up a situation where people have gone from highly structured environments that are for them to no structured environment where anything can happen. So my
son never quite got suspended, although I got many angry phone calls from teachers. He's a class clown. Who would have thought?
That's just shocking.
I'm trying to think what would have happened if he was suspended. Like, I wouldn't stop working to stay home with him.
Well, you can't. A lot of people can't. You'll lose your job.
Right.
But I know that people are experimenting with in-house suspension, and I don't know that that's any better. I mean,
what is that?
In-house suspension is where you get suspended, but it means you go to a room in the school, and someone is supervising you in that room. So you're not being sent home to, you know, an empty house or to get into trouble there. But I don't know that that's much better. I don't know if you. What do you think, Peter?
Well, so this is a thing right now. And last Monday, Gavin Newsom signed into law, SB 419, which actually bans schools from suspending students in grades K through 8 for what we have long called willful defiance. We could talk about what that means, because there's a problem there in the terminology, but the argument is that keeping them in school and working through whatever's going on is better than pushing them out of school and not working on it and seeing what happens.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Peter Williamson about the school to prison pipeline. So do tell us, what is willful defiance? What does that look like? What does that mean?
Well, it isn't defined, and that's part of the problem. So is willful defiance, a teacher says, you know, put your pencil away, and you continue to tap it, or is willful defiance screaming at somebody and throwing a chair? There's not a clear definition, and the term has been used to punish people for all sorts of activity that varies pretty widely. And so...
Is this where disproportionality reaches in?
Yeah. So at the beginning of our show, you mentioned that black and brown kids are disproportionately punished in this way. Willful defiance is the term that has been used as a weapon to push those kids out of school. There's a study that was just done by Tyrone Howard and others at UCLA called Get Out. Is the title, and it shows how systematically that's happening, that black and brown kids are being kicked out of school for sometimes what we would usually think of as a minor infraction.
I even read that kindergartners are being punished, and Black kindergartners are being punished disproportionately. So it's, you know, this starts early, early on. And it's because they can't sit in a circle or something. It's not even like they threw a chair. My gosh, right? It's what you would expect a normal, to me, normal five-year-old, and mostly I'm going to say boys because it is mostly boys at that age. You know, five-year-old boys don't sit. They don't sit. That's not how they're hardwired.
But I'm a teacher, and I've got a kid who's squirming too much, and I have to pay too much attention to him, and I can't pay attention to the other kids, so send him to the principal's office.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that sort of the move?
Well, or medicate them. I mean, a lot of
or medicate them.
I mean,
as teacher, I probably wouldn't do that.
No, you couldn't do that. But you would. There's often the teachers are recommending that these little kids who are really just showing normal developmental behavior
right.
be medicated
right.
so that they can sit in a circle and listen to story time.
The school with the highest suspension rate of African American kids. Is an elementary school in San Mateo County.
Oh, my goodness. Highest suspension rate of African-American kids in the county?
In their school.
Oh, in their school.
The percentage of the kids in their school that they send out.
Wow.
Highest percent.
Wow.
50% of their suspensions are Black kids.
Wow.
So that's interesting. So in special education, you know, which is also an area fraught with misdiagnosis, right, that runs along lines of bias, in different parts of the country, you'll see different racial groups designated as special education more than other racial groups, but it varies by the part of the country, right? Sort of reflecting the bias. Is this sort of the case here where you find that some states are much, much more likely to send kids to suspend or expel kids? Is this very?
The data shows that it's all states. And so, yeah, different groups are identified with learning needs of a certain kind, but you know, the degree to which they then feel like they belong in school, or school is for them, or they are getting anything out of school, it's another push-out question. You know, if they're being labeled as different, are they being pushed out of regular ed and into something else, and is that desirable? And so there's a real connection between people who have been identified as special education students and kids who later end up in the juvenile justice system.
That's interesting.
And you have to wonder, is that because, well, one, is this just racism? Is this just, you know, racist teachers? Majority of teachers are white. They're not people of color. Can it be explained simply by racism? And, or, is this low-income kids, particularly kids of color, are not usually participating in preschool or high-quality preschool, so maybe they enter school not ready, so they enter school behind. Is it that we're not accounting for culturally appropriate pedagogy? How do you explain this?
I think you just came up with three terrific explanations, and I would say it's a yes-and answer to that. Racism is certainly a part of all of your three, right? Institutionalized racism governs the resources that kids get and the supports they get.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're speaking with Peter Williamson, director of the teacher education program at Stanford, about the school to prison pipeline and what's causing a disproportionate number of kids of color to end up in U.S. prisons and jails.
So you may not be able to do this, but I was wondering if you could sort of give a telling story about a specific child, the kind of what is the trajectory, you know, that occurs here.
Especially because I know you've worked with kids one-on-one, right?
Well, and I work a lot of Fridays in the San Francisco Juvenile Detention Center. So I work with the teachers there to plan and enact curriculum, usually on Fridays. So I've been doing that for 10 years and
why?
Have a lot of...
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, there's a long story. The short version of the story is one of my student teachers 10 years ago asked if she could be placed at the jail for her student teaching placement. And I thought, I can't come up with a good reason why that's not a good idea. And so I'm going to be her supervisor and I'm going to go with her. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love with the work and the kids.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
It's awesome. I know some of my students in my curriculum class have written curricula for in schools that take place in prisons. And, you know, at much as deserving as any other person of a great curricula. And it's nice that you're doing that.
Thank you. And thanks to the teachers in the jail. Megan and Constance are amazing people.
So what can you give me a sample child?
I can. Of course, I won't name the child, even though he is now an adult. But I began working at the Juvenile Justice Center, as I said, 10 years ago. Met a child who was there for running away from his group home, which is a crime. He was sent back to his group home once he had done his time, so to speak.
Group home is like foster care or?
Usually a foster care situation, often with multiple kids in one house.
Yeah.
Sometimes as many as, 10, 15 kids in one house. Sometimes just one kid. Mm-hmm. But his situation was such that he felt like he wasn't being cared for in the home so that he was assigned to. And he would run away repeatedly. So when I saw him 7 years later back in the Juvenile Justice Center, he wanted to make sure I recognized that that was him, even though I'd seen him many times, and told me that he'd prefer to be there than in the homes that he was being assigned.
Mm. Wow.
And so he stayed there until he was 19.
And the school didn't provide refuge from the home? Like he was getting suspended out of school, so he was spending time in the home. Was there that triangle in there?
His public school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So when you think about the school to prison pipeline, we're going to come back and talk about this. But what are the answers when someone's choosing a school in jail over a public school that they should attend? I think that's wild.
Let me make that a sharper question. Cause,
thank you, Dan.
Well, we don't know. It could be that the home was so horrible. It wasn't the school. But the teacher is, a primary caregiver in this situation. Like you said, they provide the structure and support. What do I do as a teacher? Just don't suspend kids. I mean, I guess that would be the easiest thing. But.
Or do this new in-house suspension. But I'm going to pause us. Because we need to take a break, so we are going to come back. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more and the answer to that question of what does a teacher do with Peter Williamson on the School to Prison Pipeline next on Sirius XM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Peter Williamson, who has an upcoming book about deconstructing the school to prison pipeline. And we left with a question.
Right. So new law in California. You're not allowed to suspend kids quite so easily anymore. So teachers have lost kind of a frontline move. But more generally, what can I do as a teacher to help prevent the pipeline?
So there's a real turn in California and elsewhere toward something that's often called restorative practices. This is a way of addressing conflict when it comes up in school by addressing the conflict itself, but in a non-punitive way, by helping the student understand what he or she has done and how it's impacted others, and helping others understand how to keep the community together, even though harm has been done. And so that's becoming quite common, actually, in schools, and teachers can be trained on how to lead restorative practices in their classrooms.
So I get the principals all in one room, and there's someone who leads a conversation with them. Is that?
It can look different. It could be a whole class conversation. It could be a conversation between three people. It's often constructed as sort of a mediated conversation around the conflict itself. And obviously, if harm has been done that's physical, if danger, that may not be the solution, right? Where it's not restorative practices for everything.
I see.
But when the opportunity is there to address a disciplinary issue in a non-punitive way, to try to do that.
I think it goes back to what you said earlier about willful defiance. If you're if you're throwing a pencil versus throwing a chair, right, or putting someone in harm's way. But I know that many parents of the affected party, let's say, well, they're both affected, but the one who feels the most injured, let's say, it's a little bit of a controversial practice because they don't feel like the kid is being disciplined properly because he just has to sit. This is what they say. He just has to sit in a room and talk and kind of say he's sorry and it won't happen again. And so there's, I know it gets controversial.
It does get controversial. And I think that that really speaks to how accustomed in our society we've become to wanting punishment, mm-hmm. wanting people to pay for what they've done. Not saying that that's wrong, but there are other ways perhaps to do that.
And I also know it's really hard for teachers to do. I mean, it's hard. They're not trained as mediators, so you may not have someone at the school who really can handle this deftly and appropriately.
So that's a great point. So you run a teacher preparation program. So how do you prepare them for this?
Well, you know, it's something that we try to thread throughout our coursework. In fact, last night's class that I taught, it was on the school-to-prison pipeline, where I troubled the metaphor a little bit, but also tried to help the teachers engage in conversations about how you shift the focus, ourselves shift the focus from what the child is doing that's bad to what the child is communicating through their behavior and what we can learn about what they need through the communication that they're giving us. And that's a real shift.
That's tough. Right. So, yeah, count to 10 before you say something. I mean, that seems very hard because it does almost feel like a personal offense, the defiance.
It often does, right? Yeah.
Well, and look, teaching is so hard, right? Delivering a curriculum and being engaging and making sure that kids are on task, just that alone, never mind all the paperwork and the parents and the politics and all that is hard. And when you have a kid or multiple kids who are not listening and you feel not being respectful, it could drive you a little crazy. Let me tell you, I'm speaking from experience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's tough. It's tough.
We've all been teachers.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
We've all been beginning teachers.
So to look at what is this child communicating, you have to be in a really good space to be able to take a step back and say, okay, he's frustrated. You know, how can I help ameliorate that?
And so that's the conversation that we try to have because the alternative is that we pathologize the child and call them a troublemaker.
Right.
And now we've given them a label, and that label leads to all sorts of things like a special education designation or some other label that is part of the push out.
Right.
And so if we are not going to pathologize children and if we are going to try to understand that the child is saying something to us. They're saying something to us about how school is working for them or how they are being treated or whether or not they've eaten. And if we can't hear those things, then we ourselves are starting them on the troublemaker path.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Peter Williamson about the school-to-prison pipeline and how certain kids may internalize labels of being troublemakers, and then it becomes part of their identity.
So now I've gone to prison. I'm a child. I've been suspended. It went downhill. I'm in prison. I am seriously labeled. You're now a teacher in the prison. What are you going to do for them? How are you going to get them so that they can reintegrate?
Well, so let me go back to your earlier question and then answer that question.
Okay.
Your earlier question is, what are we doing to prepare teachers? I personally take the candidates in the Stanford Teacher Education Program into the Juvenile Justice Center in San Francisco so that they can not only see what practice looks like in those settings, but also have a deeper understanding. This is now going to answer your
very good
other question.
This is why you've written such a great book.
To they need to have a better understanding of the carceral system generally, and they need to know what the child has experienced when they left their classroom, because how can you welcome a child back into integrating them into your curriculum, into your student body, without having a better understanding of what they've experienced while they were gone? And I think the go-to assumption for most of us is that if a child is not in school, they are cutting, or they have made the choice in some way or another to go visit somebody or do something. And a real possibility is that they've been in jail. And we do not have good systems set up to have the jail communicate to the teacher, by the way, the student's coming back. And so we need to be ready to ask the questions and also have the empathy to understand that this child may have been locked up for a week, for a month, for 6 months, and that bringing them back into a math class is going to take a little extra attention than your seat's over there. Here's the work you missed. That's not going to work.
Well, and I would think, too, from what I know from prison education, is it doesn't look like typical school education, because it can't, because it doesn't work. You're not going to take someone from a system that didn't work and try a whole same system, right? That's just hitting your head against the wall. So I would think it would be really hard to transition, because the what I know of some schools and prisons is they're highly innovative, progressive. One of the curriculum that my students worked on was how to make it in the music industry. So all of a sudden now you've got motivation, you've got content that they're interested in, you've got unique ways of teaching where they're playing rap music and they're deconstructing the lyrics, not stuff that you do in your typical, you know, public school.
That's right, and that's why bringing teachers into those settings in order to help them see those practices in action, I think can help them re-envision what they can do in a general education classroom. My experience after 10 years working in San Francisco is that a lot of the students that are in these classes appear to me to come to see themselves as writers and readers for the first time in that setting. And the curriculum gives them a voice and a platform that they didn't feel like they had in general education classrooms. And it's pretty powerful to watch them in some ways come to life around things like reading and writing in ways they might have simply dismissed in their 11th grade English class.
Thanks for being here, Peter. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app, on iTunes, and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.